Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are pleased to be with Bernard Cornwell. I remember vividly standing on a hill in Wales in a Roman ruin. And from this hill, I could see where the Romans had been. There was something, I don't remember what, that was Saxon. There was, oh, it was where the Prince of Wales is invested. So you could be in a...
Oh, that's Dorchester, yes.
You could be standing in a Roman thing. You could be seeing where the Saxons get displaced by the Normans, and then there was something quite modern as well. But
I said this was Caernarfon.
It was Caernarfon, that's right. So it began to have a sense of ancient being melded with modern.
And back over, you know, another few miles
was a Welsh castle.
Was one of these early Welsh castles. It was about as big as this room and very vertical. Just as if they, just when they were beginning to go back to using stone to build fortifications.
We don't have that sense in the United States of the really, unless, of course, one goes to the Indian mounds, and you can go back 10,000 years with that, the Native American Indian mounds. But it isn't the same sense of technology. And I really was quite drawn in The Last Kingdom to be thinking about the role of the Romans, because I don't think much about the Romans except, oh, yeah, let's see, that was the last empire that failed, and maybe we'll do that too in the United States. I don't know. But that sense of how dominant the Romans, off at the very edge of their empire, were in England.
Yes.
Was surprising to me. Probably not to you, but it was to me.
Well, the Romans tried very hard to make Britain into the model colony. After the sort of huge failure of Roman policy when you had Boudicca's rebellion, after that a sort of concerted effort was made to actually turn this into the model colony. I mean, for instance, at Colchester, they built what was probably the largest building outside Rome. They built an incredible road network. All the Roman towns, because the Romans never got into Scotland and, of course, never went to Ireland. And they do leave a legacy, and it's a legacy which is, in a sense, is broken by the coming of the Saxons, because the Saxons were not colonized by the Romans. But nevertheless, they're moving into a society that was. And so what the Saxons find when they get there are these roads, for a start, which they can't build, which they still use. We know they still use them. I mean, the tactics of the military, or rather strategy, all military strategy in that period, is dictated by the layout of the Roman roads. Certainly the Danes were very fond of finding a Roman place because it might well have the Roman walls left, which saved them a lot of building. And the Last Kingdom begins with the siege of York, which the Saxons called the Offerwick, and the Romans were going to call, I mean, the Danes were called Jorvik. It's defended by Roman walls. Go back to my guy in Bath, we can't build this stuff. I mean, what they can build is wooden palisades. And of course, one of the lovely things about growing up, for me in England, was that you were, as you say, surrounded by this. I mean, I came from a nothing little village, but the nothing little village had got a stone in the churchyard, which was believed that if you, well, our belief, what I was told was that if you walked three times around the stone and then stooped and spoke into the hole, you spoke directly to the devil. But the name of the village, in fact, was Thundersley, and where that came from, a Danish settlement who believed that the god Thor was buried in the ridge on which the village was. So almost certainly the stone, which is pre-Christian, was there before the church. The Danes probably thought you communicated to Thor through that, and whoever was there before the Danes probably had another, because it's a rather extraordinary-looking stone with this sort of big hole in it. It is nice growing up with that. It is part of everyday life.
Again, in Wales, I was taken by the incredible age of the trees.
Well, you've got them here, dear. They're just as old.
Well, fewer.
Here, you know, we don't corner trees there.
But
we do have forts that are 4,000 years old. Which is
there was a sense that, and of course, the trees now, even in England, has been fairly deforested. But there was what we don't have in this country, in this culture, is the experience of having worshipped those trees and been one with them. That we don't have. We have the old trees, and we're not really respectful of them. We tend to cut them down. But that sense of that ancient reach into to being honoring the trees in a special way, that we don't have. But in America, we're technological.
But I'm not sure they have it in Britain either. I think that too got lost. And in fact, the deforestation of Britain goes back so far that, I mean, every time a new book is published, it tends to push it back another 1,000 years. I mean, people say what a wonderful landscape the English landscape is. It's a man-made landscape. The last time I can think where trees occupied a special place in people's mythology and regard was probably the old British religion of Druidism.
That's the old people.
That's the old people, because they did worship in groves of trees. So you have a place named like Derry in Ireland. Derry means oak grove, and is almost certainly a place where, in fact, the Druids had a temple. Though the temple may have been the trees themselves. We know so little about Druidism. I think once that had gone, I don't see much animism in British religion after that. There's certainly none in the worship of Woden and Thor, which the Saxons brought with them, and they have, I think, a rather utilitarian view of the land, and which has to be looked after. You must look after the land. But that will actually, you know, the job of forester was a very important job, but you are pollarding trees for your own purposes. But it does preserve them. I think that America does have a great regard for its landscape and for its... I mean, there's now more forest than what were the 13 colonies than there were when the colonists arrived. And there is a great love, I think, of landscape here, and a great pride in landscape, as there should be.
Well, it's also worth remembering why Jamestown was founded.
Was because England was out of trees to make glass, so they sent the second and third sons to a place where there were lots of trees and plenty of sand, and the very first industry in America was glass factories, because they were out of trees. The carrying that forward in terms of thinking about the spirited land, do you have that same sense when you're in other parts of history, when you were doing the Sharp series? Do you have that same sense of connection to the land?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I mean, by now, I mean, dear Richard Sharp, I mean, his connection with the land is finding a hill to protect your men from French artillery fire. There's not much reference for land, I think, in the early 19th century. Although, of course, you have the great romantic poets who are. And, I mean, there's no doubt that a reverence for landscape is embedded in mankind. And I think that people find landscape beautiful. I don't think Sharp does. I think Sharp is all too much a soldier.
It's topography.
Do you miss old Sharp?
Oh, I'll be writing more Sharp. He's not done yet. There are 20 books, but there's I've already planned the 21st. But I probably won't write it this year. It's probably the thing I'll do next year.
How do you have time to do what has to be lots of research and to write?
It's partly an absolute love of it. I mean, the Alfred books, I wrote the first, was it last year? But I've probably been reading the Saxons for 20 years and thinking about the book for 10. And then suddenly you put on a spurt. Do all the research in a rush, but in fact it's on a background of 10 or 20 years reading.
So when you were in Belfast, being a BBC guy, you had things cooking in the back of your head?
Yeah, I think so, but at that time I didn't know I was ever going to end up as a novelist. I mean, as far as I knew, I was simply going to go on working in television and you know, in Ireland, probably going back to England eventually. But yes, I always wanted to be a writer, and I always wanted to be an historical novelist, but I never thought it would happen.
Well, it's an interesting story about strategic planning. People talk about sitting down and planning out your life and what you want to be when you grow up and all the things that go with it. And your story is a little less, cognitive.
Yeah. Well, starting with being a war baby, you don't plan these things.
You don't plan these things, do you? No, I mean, you can't. But no, what took me by surprise was meeting an American. And this was in Belfast. And I'm not going to say it was love at first sight, because I don't believe in it. It was lust at first sight.
That one can believe
it. That I do believe in. And I said to the guy I was with, I said, the moment I saw her, I said, I'm going to marry that one. And I did. And we are still married 20-something years later. But it was because Judy couldn't live in Britain for family reasons, and I didn't have family ties, and I could move to the States, but I couldn't get a green card. And so I said, well, don't worry, I'll write a book. And that was the first Sharp book. And 25 years later, I'm still doing it, 27 years later, I think.
That isn't just because you wrote the book. You wrote a good book that people would buy.
Well, I was lucky, wasn't I? It worked. I mean, when I look back, it was a mad thing to suggest, and it was a mad thing to do. I mean, it's something you do for love, and one would never recommend it. I mean, you would never say to one of your children, whatever you do, just give up your career, move 3,000 miles.
Actually, that sort of describes what I did.
Oh, there you go.
So one doesn't do everything rationally.
So maybe careers advisors listening to this should start actually recommending extreme irresponsibility.
Follow your bliss is how I think it was.
Well, following your bliss is good, and it worked for me, but I suppose it's also true that I'd always wanted to be a novelist. But I mean, that's true of lots and lots of people, and for every thousand who want to be, it's very few who probably ever get the chance. Well, one, it's a dangerous thing to do. It's you give up a well-paid job and you give up pension rights and all those good things to do something which has no guarantee of success whatsoever. And I think if I'd not fallen in love with Judy, I would never have done it. I'd never have tried it. I admire those people. There are so many of them who can hold down either a full-time job or being a housewife, which is a full-time job, and write books. And I don't know how they do it. I mean, people say to me, what's your advice? If I want to be a writer, what do I need? I say, get a good spouse.
So you have the time and the wherewithal.
Takes the pressure off you,
this
yes.
reminds me of Melvin Connor, who's probably best known for writing The Tangled Wing, the biological limits on the human spirit.
Yeah, biological constraints on the human spirit. He's an anthropologist.
But he also wrote a book called Why the Reckless Survive. And his argument is essentially a genetic argument, and what he should have titled it is Why the Genes of the Reckless Survive.
That the reckless may procreate, but they may not live very long.
They live long enough to procreate.
Yes.
We are with Bernard Cornwell, who's well known for his Sharp series, for Arthurian series, and is now about to be well known for his Alfredian, Can I Do That series, starting with The Last Kingdom. Be with us when we return in a moment with The Paula Gordon Show.